You're listening to the GP Supervisors Australia podcast, Teaching Professional and Ethical Practice, presented by Dr. Simon Morgan and Dr. Justin Coleman. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
So welcome along all. My name's Simon Morgan. I'm a medical educator and I'm being joined very capably tonight by Justin Coleman. Justin's a GP up on the Tiwi Islands in the community of Warramyunga and is a very well-regarded medical writer, which many of you will have read some of the over 1,500 articles he's published in various publications. He's also got an expertise and a direct role in GP supervisor education in his work in the Northern Territory. So very quick overview before we wet our ankles in the pool of professionalism. Three tips for success in GP supervision, aka why this talk is on professionalism. And so very much around the theme that's run through these new supervisor workshops, I wish to highlight these really important elements of GP supervision that I think marry in really nicely with teaching ethical and professional practice. The first one is on focus on skill development. We are, as supervisors, pushed towards the clinical and pushed towards knowledge. And so if we can step back and take more of a focus on skill development, and in this case, this is professionalism, skills in being a professional doctor, we really are equipping our registrars with the skills for competent and safe and professional practice into the future. The second tip and the second connection with professionalism is this notion of unknown learning needs. Very much this sense that registrars will often come to us as supervisors, as educators, with the things they know they don't know and they're wishing to fill. It's our role to uncover, to shine the light on the unknown unknowns. And very much these are the non-clinical elements of practice, things like professionalism. And there really the third point is that emphasis on those non-clinical domains of practice. So if we allow it to occur, we will spend our day talking about the diagnosis and management of skin rashes. But importantly, we need to think about professionalism, organizational skills, communication, and those other domains of practice. And really, the core learning objectives are, we'll be talking about what is medical professionalism. We'll be talking about assessment and practically and importantly, how we can use specific teaching and learning strategies to foster professional and ethical practice in our registrars. Now, if all else fails, apparently, all you need to do is to sling a stethoscope around your neck. And a study that was published a few years ago now would suggest that by wearing a stethoscope, non-medical people would rate doctors as being more professional. Is that something you do in practice? If so, is it to deliberately look a little more like the doctor around the place?
I must say the stethoscope around the neck is a very handy place to carry it. But no, I think in my place, I tend to just walk humbly around in my plain clothes and people can figure out I'm a doctor. So no, I don't rely so much on the stethoscope, although it's a good hint if you're feeling in trouble.
Of all the medical items, it was the stethoscope that had the greatest impact, with more than twice the influence of other medical items, such as a reflex hammer or an otoscope. So if you're carrying a reflex hammer around to try to look more professional, it's going to have half the impact as if you're wearing a stethoscope. So let's start with a definition. What attributes and behaviours define ethical and professional practice? Let's imagine, Justin, you've got a medical student in the practice at Warramyunga and they say, you know, medical school's been great and we've learned lots of good clinical stuff, but there's this thing, professionalism. I must say, I went to sleep during the lecture. It was really dull. You're a GP, surely you practice in a professional way. What is it to you? What constitutes professionalism in general practice?
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, one of the big things I would like to think is that I act professionally and model professionalism. It is hard to define. I think certainly if you're talking the talk without being professional and they can see you being a bit dodgy, then it's not a good thing. So the students who come, and we have 10-week placements of medical students, which is very intensive. And part of that really is, I think, modelling how you would expect to behave and being kind to patients. When you talk through patient consultations after the event and you talk about what happened, I think respecting even the more difficult patients. And so patient-centred quality and confidential practice. And again, I think when you're modelling that, you particularly in a small town where I am, you can talk about patients in a very confidential way, but you don't sort of talk about them in a broader forum.
It's interesting, patient-centeredness. I think absolutely. Maybe we don't connect patient-centeredness with professionalism as strongly as it might be, but the literature certainly supports that connection. The behaviours and attributes expected in our discipline. Now, Justin studied Latin. What's professionalism? What's the etymology of the word professionalism, Justin?
You did give me a bit of a heads up on this one, Simon. So pro certainly means for or forwards. And fes is something to do with speaking or saying. So that would be my guess on it.
Yeah. And so it's very much that sense of to speak forth, what it represents of the discipline. So there's lots of individual things that we do in our interactions with patients, and I guess as a community, but it's what others expect of us. And professionalism clearly relates to all disciplines, not just medicine, but medical professionalism is quite a specific thing.
Part of role modelling, I think, is to accept you don't know everything, except you'll get some things wrong. And it's the way you approach that when it happens, I think, that is the true mark of professionalism.
So you know it when you see it. I think that's fabulous. And perhaps a better quote would be, you know it when it's not there. You know it when it's absent. And so a bit like many of the things we talk about in GP education, clinical reasoning perhaps being a good example, they're sometimes really hard to unpack. So if you are struggling to articulate to your medical student sitting in the corner or your registrar indeed what professionalism is, it's probably because it's a definition that's subject to change over time. And clearly professionalism now is very different to 20 or 50 or 100 years ago. And it's very dependent on context. So professionalism in the Tiwi Islands is very different to professionalism in urban Newcastle and certainly in other countries around the world. So it's a very sort of fluid concept, but the Australian Medical Board and the AMA would consider these types of themes as constituting professionalism. Things like self-awareness and self-reflection, so being self-aware of, and that is, does include limitations, and this notion of a collective identity, that we're part of something bigger than just our individual interactions with patients. And certainly that idea of maintaining skills, knowledge, and the appropriate attitudes to practice effectively. And that's the whole thing around lifelong learning. It's not bad context to point registrars to, that there are some landmark documents that it's not unreasonable to think a registrar may actually read or at least access. One was the CanMed framework, which put professionalism as one of the seven really key elements of the medical professional. And then the Physician's Charter, which came out of North America in 2002. And it talked about these concepts around the primacy of patient welfare, the importance of patient autonomy. And we had a bit of a discussion about this at a recent webinar, and maybe how our relationship with society and societal justice and distributive justice, those sorts of things, this interaction of the individual doctor with a broader community, how that's changed over time, how my connection with the community is different to, say, yours, Justin, in a small, remote Aboriginal community, and how much your professional role actually is greater or lesser in that domain than mine.
Certainly, Simon and I have talked about this in the past, that some professionalism things do vary according to context. Some are just very much you should do this, but I guess with most ethical and moral codes and rights, all those sorts of things, there's always a hierarchy of them. There's very, very few absolutisms. So Simon and I were chatting last week about how confidentiality might mean something slightly different in an Aboriginal health setting where I work, where five people walk into the room and one of them, who's not necessarily the patient, is expected to be the person who gets everything done and all the decisions made. So not that you ever throw confidentiality out the window no matter where you are, but there are subtleties and approaches. And I guess that hierarchy does vary slightly depending on your setting.
Privacy is part of professionalism. And Justin's been alluding to this paper. I'd really strongly encourage you to read it. It's in Australian Family Physician, so it's readily accessible. It's written by an academic GP from Justin's old stomping ground in Brisbane, Nancy Sturman. And she described the reflections of medical students as they sat in with Australian GPs and their professional practice and how, in a sense, that varied from a very textbook, black and white, written moral code, as we talk about, and how, as GPs, probably more than any other discipline, there's these challenges in the way we practice. And it's all to do, obviously, with our intimacy with the patient, our longitudinal relationship, our involvement with the family and the community, our depth of engagement. And so many of the otherwise relatively clear aspects of professional and ethical practice that these medical students were aware of were bending rules and things were grey and, oh, gee, really, that's the way you do it? Is that professional? And yet in our setting, as Justin's alluded to, and certainly in a remote community, but in all our settings, we're aware that we sometimes change the goalposts a little bit. And we probably all feel wholly comfortable that's still professional practice. And I think this is absolutely core to sitting and talking with a registrar about how practice in a hospital setting or what you might read in the AMA guidelines might be just nuanced in a general practice setting. And that's, again, not to say this is sort of wholesale unprofessional practice. It's just a little bit different. I guess this is about a dialogue with registrars and trying to get a sense of who they are and where their professionalism sits and how they respond to the environment they're suddenly working in.
The basic concept of treating people equally, regardless of background, which of course is very important. And as Simon said at the start, it's interesting, we could certainly pick a lack of ethics or a lack of professionalism. And we read about those in politicians frequently and in doctors occasionally. So certainly where the decision the doctor makes is purely for self-interest or without thinking they do something poorly, then that doesn't pass the pub test. You could sit down and say to people, do you think this is reasonable? A bunch of med students, for example, and if they say no, it's probably not reasonable. But yeah, those grey areas are certainly situational and it does depend perhaps a little bit on the intent of the doctor. But like so many things in medicine, it's very hard to get right all the time. And I think our aim is to strive towards being as good as we can and learning and getting better and talking to other people about it as well.
I remember actually working with a registrar who genuinely felt that the patient wasn't sitting in front of them in that traditional doctor-patient engagement in the consultation room, then it wasn't appropriate for him to talk to them. So clearly where good professional practice starts and stops is a very wide margin. That notion, and I think registrars sometimes fall into that trap of wanting to be liked by all our patients. And I think it's a fallacy to feel our patients will all like us. I guess we all aim for our patients to respect us, and certainly trust is the epitome of both. And so this is a bit unfair and certainly stereotypical, but the respected but possibly less caring or less warm practitioner, so low caring, high competence, and these are the doctors that we respect, we're very happy for them to do our hip, but maybe not the great bedside manner. And of course we all have encountered doctors and indeed have probably seen registrars who are very, very nice. We may have worked with these practitioners who are lovely and caring, and yet their competence is pretty poor when you actually scratch the surface. The aspiration for our registrars and for ourselves is to being highly caring and highly competent. That's what we're aspiring to be, highly trusted. So we'll move on to assessment.
It would be very handy if we could dump any of our registrars on the professionalism meter and see how professional they are, because we could come up with a number and that would give us an answer. And we could even do it for a colleague or two. The question is, how do we assess it? Direct observation. I think Simon and I would both agree that that's an excellent method of doing it. So direct observation, the beauty is you see the person in action. It's not a be-all and end-all because, of course, they may be the Hawthorne effect. They may be more professional while they're being observed than when they're not. Feedback from colleagues, I think, is wonderful. So there's that concept of the 360-degree feedback, which is all the rage these days. Colleagues, certainly other doctors, but then you go beyond that. And I think there are many of us who would have been alerted to something not being quite right by the practice nurse, who I think is in an excellent situation to judge these things, and the reception staff. Because realistically, if you have a registrar who's incredibly polite to you, but not so much to the staff who are helping them, I think that's a bad sign. Patients, tell us about that, Simon.
Patient feedback and complaints. Yeah, so we sometimes have the opportunistic collection of assessment data by seeing a patient after the registrar has seen them and get a sense of who they were and what they've done.
Patient surveys is probably a more formal option, which I think some of the RTOs, regional training organisations, do organise patient surveys. And sometimes for the colleges, you organise patient surveys, which is interesting. That gives you a rating. I don't mind those at all. It's quite a hassle. And usually it's for accreditation and things, we get them done. But it gives us a bit of insight. Self-appraisal. Asking the registrar to rate themselves. Of course, you don't get the unknown unknowns and it's a very biased observer, but still they can talk about their own weaknesses or dilemmas there. Multi-source feedback is mentioned a number of times, direct observation as well, patient opinion certainly. And after the registrar's been there for 2 or 3 months, you're almost always going to see some of the patients who've seen them. I do tend to ask the patients I know and trust, I guess, the patient's opinion. I do tend to ask them how they felt. Case discussion is interesting. We can talk about that perhaps a little bit later, and random case analysis and scenario-based teaching. So those things are some more formal tools. So the case discussion and random case analysis are really looking at what the registrar has done. So you go back over their notes from yesterday. It can be a bit tricky to judge professionalism in those, although sometimes you can get some sort of concept. For example, you may discover that your registrar never phones patients and everyone else in the practice phones patients, and you might ask why they've decided that that's a specific rule for them. And then scenario-based teaching, it's a bit like posing dilemmas. There's a set of tools you can use to say, what would you do in this situation? With the case discussion, one thing you can do is talk about, okay, well, this is the person you saw. What if, say, if the person was, and you can alter the nature of the person or alter what the person said to present a bit of an ethical dilemma. Say if that person asked you for this and you weren't comfortable, how would you approach that? There's various ways of assessing them. And I think using a smattering of them over a 6 month term is a useful thing.
Probably that just reflects the nature of this domain of practice, that it is very subjective and it requires a sort of nuanced observation. And also, as Justin's alluded to, I think it requires sort of multiple data points across time to get a sense of a registrar's professionalism interacting with different people and across different aspects of practice. So I don't know if that answered that question about how to do it, but I think I would strongly recommend and encourage thinking about professionalism as part of a case discussion, but very much not allowing the case discussion to gravitate to where the registrar wants to take it, but posing the what ifs and looking for the professional and ethical dilemmas or domains within that encounter. So we are going to look at some scenarios. So the most expensive gift I would accept from a patient would be worth what? How do we talk to registrars about the influence of gifts and what is appropriate and what's not? And is it reasonable to not accept a dozen eggs from a patient in a rural setting compared to football tickets at the SCG from a patient who's very grateful that you've been caring for their ill wife? Where does it start and stop? What are the concerns here? And there are some guidelines set. I think they're certainly not dollar values. They talk about modest gifts, But we know that people are going to have their line in the sand very variably.
So looking at family members or friends as patients. So I see family members or friends as patients, never in emergencies, for minor things, or as a regular treating doctor. Simon and I were talking about this recently and pointing out possibly one difference might be geographic area. Certainly in a small town, if you happen to be the best at cutting out skin lesions and your family member has a skin lesion to cut out, perhaps you'd do it, perhaps you wouldn't. Whereas if there's very easy access to lots of other GPs in the larger city, perhaps you'd be more reluctant to do anything at all.
I think the other cohort that we do and should talk to our registrars about seeing, not just family and friends, is practice staff, because we've probably all seen challenges with that. And my advice would be to really try to avoid practice staff seeing your registrars, because I think it's highly problematic and they're usually not sufficiently experienced to see practice staff and not feel compromised by the boundaries that might be crossed. But I think that's a challenging area of practice. So I reveal the following things about myself to patients. And again, this is you and your patients, but thinking about your new, you know, GPT1, 2 months in, thinking, gee, they're oversharing about their health issues or their family circumstances, or gosh, it wouldn't be a bad thing if they could just open up a little bit about who they are. So yeah, I disclose nothing, generalities, health issues, both of the above, or I'm happy to tell them everything there is.
In a small town, I mean, let's face it, most of the patients know me anyway, know my background. So you really do. So currently I'm in a place of 1,500 people, which is an island. You know, I spend all my life here and socialize with people on the weekends. So to never talk about family for me would be a bit of a falsehood. It certainly would be different if I lived in one suburb of a city and commuted across, you know, 10 other suburbs to get to my workplace and was never there after hours. It would be a different scenario.
And again, how do we communicate that to registrars? Is that reasonable? Do we need to be selective and careful about which patients we actually talk to about those sorts of health issues? Is it taking the focus away from the patient and more onto ourselves if we start talking about our own issues? I don't know that I have answers for this, but just some of the things I'm hoping you might reflect on when you're thinking about registrars.
Patients sometimes ask specifically, like, do you have kids or something like that? In which case, yeah, it takes a bit more effort to say, well, I'd prefer not to disclose that, presumably is what you'd say if you decided not to disclose, which is fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I would find that a bit awkward. It depends on how long and well you know the patient. And I do think that's true. Certainly my attitude towards a patient who I know is just a genuine person, I've seen them, you know, through thick and thin, and particularly they're just a sensible sort of community person, I'd certainly have a lower threshold for discussing things with them. Or if, you know, if they're into surfing and I'm into surfing, or they're into fishing, I'm into fishing, all that sort of stuff. So it does depend on the individual for some people. I allow my patients to hug me. Now, this is a biggie. And Simon and I think, are a bit different in this, and there'll be a few different opinions here. So only if I can't duck out of it, yes, and I initiate hugs. Now, I must fess up, I'm not a hugger. I'm a nice person. I really do think so, but not a hugger.
I certainly have recollections of being chased around the room by very tactile elderly women who just want to give me a big hug to thank me. And they're the ones who tend to always smell very strongly of perfume. And if I get hugged, then I smell of perfume for the rest of the day, which I think is a bit of a downside. But, you know, registrars won't know what to do. They just will think, is it appropriate in this general practice setting to give an elderly woman who's just lost her husband to cancer a bit of a hug as she leaves to say, I'm really sorry for your loss? Is that grossly inappropriate? Or is, in fact, that's exactly the kind of support that woman needs at that time? One of the joys of being a medical educator is looking at the background and searching PubMed and coming across the most extraordinary articles published in the BJGP, but it actually talked about what's appropriate by way of touch. Is it okay to touch people, and where we can touch people safely. Is the top of the shoulder or the back okay? Is the forearm seems to be pretty safe? Is it reasonable to give somebody a hug? And so this is all important context to help a registrar navigate what's going to be a pretty challenging environment. I write prescriptions for myself. Short-term things like antibiotics, long-term medications like antihypertensives, yes for both, or no, that would be an unprofessional act. But of course, the medical students sitting in the room, you know, seeing these grey areas of practice, some of the other 55% who would write scripts for themselves or have written scripts for themselves, and maybe there's contextual things there that make those activities certainly acceptable, if not by the letter of the code of conduct. Is it okay you're running out of your antidepressant or your antihypertensive to write the script and take it down to the chemist so you don't suffer the withdrawal effects of not having any escitalopram?
It is illegal in Victoria. It's interesting how many would write themselves scripts. The reason I would get a registrar to do it is precisely so I didn't write one myself. Yeah, the ongoing scripts is interesting. When doctors talk about dumbing things down and pharmacists sort of allowing just ongoing contraceptive pills or ongoing antihypertensive, we do get up in arms a bit, a few of us, probably myself included, and say, look, you know, an antihypertensive ongoing script isn't just a automatic thing. You do have to reassess the cardiovascular risk and things like that and think about titrating, down titrating, deprescribing and prescribing. So I myself do tend towards that never write a script for yourself.
So let's talk a little bit about teaching and learning. And so how do we teach this stuff? You've all come along to learn basically about professional ethical practice and how do we try to impart the knowledge and skills to our registrars. Justin mentioned role modelling, and it has been described in the literature as one of the most powerful teaching methods we have. So the way we model practice, model the way we work, is an extraordinarily powerful influence on registrars. And that is across the domain, the way we treat staff, the way we run to time, and certainly the way we prescribe and the way we dress, all those things have an influence. And there is also a description in the literature that if we unpack some of that role modeling and sort of marry what we're doing in the background with actually an explicit discussion of the way I practice, it actually helps reinforce some of those skills. So very broad general strategy is basically the way you act will influence your registrar. Much of this we talked about, self-awareness, self-reflection, encouraging self-reflection in registrars, and to actually stop and think and reflect and unpack a consultation and say, not just did I get the diagnosis, but how was my professional practice within that encounter? And more generally with staff and the way I engage with those around me. Feedback, clearly, the notion of two-way learning and that very supportive, non-blame, open, safe practice culture to allow these conversations to flourish. Again, if there's one thing I can encourage you as supervisors to do with your registrars in, as they train, it's just to get them to take a breath and to not rush headlong through their training and through their patients and through their study and through their exams and get out the other side, but just to stop and think and reflect about what they're doing. And then there's a bunch of really specific strategies. But what I will encourage you to do very, very strongly is to go to the GPSA website and download the Teaching Professionalism in General Practice Guide. And it talks about some of these specific things. Setting expectations. Welcome to the practice. Here's the resuscitation trolley. This is the practice manager. This is what professionalism looks like in our practice. I would like you to sign this document once you've read the medical board code of conduct. And we encourage our staff in this practice not just to think about confidentiality and some of those other aspects, but globally how they're professional. And there are actually templates of professionalism contracts that many practices use. Justin talked about assessments, and obviously we never ever assess without provision of feedback and hopefully some teaching as part of it. These sorts of things, role play, case discussion, critical analysis of near misses and things, are assessment tools, but they're also teaching tools. And then, of course, there's a whole range of specific aspects of professionalism. Well, I remember reading from the academic base of teaching professionalism, how do you do it? They talk about two elements. One is this teaching the cognitive base. It's basically, what does confidentiality look like in general practice? How do you communicate well with somebody? What good records look like? How do you maintain boundaries with the patient? That's the cognitive base. But there's also this sort of broad moral endeavor. And that's really the nuanced gray stuff that we talked about, you know, when you see it. And that's really only can be done by role modeling. So role model well and teach the specifics. And of course, if there's unprofessional behavior, you need to remediate it. We probably haven't touched enough on self-care. I think we've alluded to it, but it falls very squarely in the domain of professionalism. So it's not just about interaction with patients, but it's interaction with self and work-life balance and the registrar being encouraged and supported to look after themselves. And of course, that goes for us as well. And in terms of resources, I've just pointed you to this guide and again, freely available on the GPSA website. And the Shades of Grey cards, they're a suite of sometimes extraordinarily challenging little scenarios in practice. They don't have answers, which you probably would expect on a series of scenarios that are around professional challenges because there's no black and white answer, clearly. But with your registrar during a teaching visit, or just get them to have a look at it if they're preparing for exams or needs to maybe uncover some unknown unknowns. And it'll be an incredibly rich experience going through some of those. A few resources. We didn't talk about social media much. I think that was a much, much hotter topic maybe 10 or 15 years ago when people were posting wholly inappropriate pictures of x-rays and things on social media. But I think possibly the hazards of that have sunk home quite a bit. So you hear less of that. The Good Medical Practice, a Code of Conduct for Doctors in Australia, has been recently revised. And it's actually a very, very readable document. It's totally digestible. And again, I would just say to your registrars as they enter the practice, have you seen this? Have you read this thing recently? As part of the orientation, can you have a look at it? And we can maybe talk about some of the aspects of it as it pertains to general practice. It's a great resource. And I would like to very much thank you, Justin, for your comments and observations and insights.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you soon. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and/or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervisors Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervisors Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.